aesthetic, a psychological, and a philosophic revolution. It greatly altered mankind's self-perspective and ushered in modern consciousness. It may be said that the rise of Romanticism signaled the death knell for classical religion. It replaced outdated religious dogma with a more relevant and a more modern anthrocentric, man-centered system for art, for history, for philosophy. It replaced man, or you replaced God, with man. And of course, by contrast, in the Havdalah of Havdalos, the Hasidim, Hasidut, they launched the Pietistic movement, which was aimed at regenerating the despondent communities of Eastern Europe. It based itself on antecedent movements, the Hasidi Ashkenaz, the Kabbalah Sa'ari, and it stressed higher levels of religious devotion, realized in more strict performance of mitzvot and more passionate tefillah. Seemingly, there is little modern or secular about the Hasidim. If Romanticism was responsible for the withdrawal of the face of God from society, from modern society, the birth of the secular city, then surely Hasidut battled for a greater awareness, a greater intimacy between man and the Ribbono Shel Olam. In these respects, it seems unlikely that the Baal Shem Tov and William Wordsworth would share any common ground. However, if we begin to focus upon the underlying ideologies, and not just the frameworks within which they blossomed, we begin to detect several very striking similarities. The movements manifested themselves in distinct and dissimilar cultural expressions, but the underlying set of beliefs which propelled these movements exhibited several marked similarities and an overall symmetry which cannot be dismissed as incidental. Ironically, it is only by investigating the sweeping generalizations which are often made about each movement that we can begin to detect their resemblance. In large part, vast generalizations are always counterproductive. They tend to oversimplify, and thereby they blur, they obscure the authentic features of a movement or of a campaign. Generalizations are very rarely productive. In our instance, however, a quick review of some of the defining features of each movement and the features which they shared might alert us to their likeness and promise us a more convincing argument upon more precise investigation. To begin with, each movement, the Romantic movement, the Hasidic movement, was revolutionary. Each developed a fresh system which sought to repair the traditional ailing one. The Romantics produced a new philosophy, a new cosmogony, a new version of world history, which expanded the version which Newton had produced and altered his version. They produced a new genre of poetry, a new perspective upon aesthetics, to replace the stale poetry, the stale literature which was being produced by what was known as the Augustan School, Alexander Pope, John Dryden, Jonathan Swift. They viewed this poetry as stale, as rigid, as unimaginative. The Hasidim, for their part, reacted. They reacted towards the corruption which they perceived had begun to victimize the organized Jewish community. A corruption which they felt led to the erosion of the authority of the rabbinate, of the rabbanim, and to a widening of the gap between the rabbanim and the general population. The type of religion which the traditional rabbanim advocated laid heavy emphasis upon erudition, upon scholarship, upon limud Torah, thereby precluding a major part of society from meaningful religious experience. How many Talmidim were there in the great yeshivas of Elazhin? A couple hundred Talmidim? The Hasidim proposed in exchange a mystical religious experience. Internal feeling became the order of the day. A religion which was led by a more charismatic leadership, which was accessible to the Talmidim, something which is also very current in today's YU. And the leaders of each movement were very conscious of the innovative nature of their doctrine. And therefore, each movement produced one seminal work which outlined the goals of the new ideology and tried to defend it against what they perceived would be heavy accusation. William Wordsworth's systematic defense of his poetry in his preface to the Lyrical Balance echoes Rabbeinu Yaakov Yosef's justification of Hasidut in Toldos Yaakov Yosef. Each work is written with an eye towards defending the innovative nature of the ideology. because each movement and each leader undoubtedly recognized that their ideas, as they were revolutionary, would be met with criticism and it would be assailed because it attacked the conventional models. And as we know, history proved that to be correct. A second point of commonality between the Hasidim and the Romantics is that, interestingly enough, each of them was a revivalist movement. Each movement saw itself as harping back to a golden and distinguished heritage. They viewed that their versions, their philosophies, weren't new. They merely revived ancient ones. William Blake, and to a lesser extent, his British contemporaries, attempted to revive a more true form of poetry, but to revive it. A form of poetry which was rooted in the biblical prophets, and the Hebrew prophets as they called it, and manifested itself in an authentic lineage of British prophets or British poets. Shakespeare, Spenser, and of course, John Milton. These were the only poets who had captured that true trace and that true lineage, and it was the Romantic responsibility to revive and to capture that. As some of you might know, Frankenstein, the character in Mary Shelley's book, Frankenstein, is educated towards Western civilization by only three books. When Frankenstein is put into a cell, he's only given three books to read. And of course, one of those books is Milton's Paradise Lost, indicating how much the Romantics viewed John Milton as the center, or as the epicenter of British culture. Similarly, the Hasidim had their own quote-unquote traditional sources with whom they identified. To some extent, they viewed themselves as reviving Hasidic Ashkenaz. But, of course, the most profound influence upon the Hasidim was exerted by the Kabbalah. Kabbalah had begun to flourish in the 16th century under the Ari HaKadosh, and the Hasidim and the Rebbeim saw in their own movement a rekindling of Lurianic Kabbalah. A third point of convergence is that each of these movements proposed a staunchly anti-rationalist system, which they proposed to combat the abuse of reason, the abuse of rationalism, which had been committed in recent history, or recent to them. The Hasidim reacted to the disproportionate emphasis which Judaism, in their mind, had placed upon learning and Limud Torah, scholasticism. To the Hasidim, pure Limud Torah, even when it was accompanied by strict Shmiras HaMitzvot, was still cold and uninspired, and ultimately was inferior to Avodas Hashem, which was animated by feeling and ecstatic emotion. The Romantics as well launched an anti-rationalist campaign. The Enlightenment in Europe had acclaimed mankind's rational faculty as its most noble aspect, capable of both revealing cosmic secrets as well as designing democratic forms of government. There was a euphoria, a confidence in ration and reason, a euphoria which pervaded every discipline, from art to science, from philosophy to music. And it was against this 18th century optimism that the Romantics battled, crusading against the use of reason, untempered by imagination or by vision. Some have defined the Romantic movement as emotion rather than reason, the heart opposed to the head. The anti-rationalist strains in each movement was different, but suffice it to say that each movement tended to reject the superiority of reason, choosing instead a more emotional system based upon sensation and imagination. Finally, and most tellingly, each movement underscored the primacy of the common man, as opposed to the heroic or exalted individual, as opposed to the Rosh Yeshiva, as opposed to the Rav. To many, the Hasidic movement can be entirely defined and explained as a reaction to this gap which had begun to develop between the intellectual elite, represented by the Rabbanim, and the uneducated masses, who were literally at the disposal of the Rabbanim. To the hordes of illiterates, the Amei Haaretz, Yiddishkeit had been reduced to an uninspired system of listless mitzvahs. Unfortunately, sometimes Rabbanim were more interested in securing their own power and augmenting their own authority than in redressing these concerns, than in reaching out to the Amei Haaretz. Chassidut gave hope to the common Yid by proposing a charismatic leader as opposed to the traditional teacher, a leader who would walk amongst the simple people and who would be attuned to their common and daily problems. I must admit that the degree of corruption has been, in my opinion, greatly exaggerated by many historians. Many historians view the entire 18th century as a corrupt rabbinate, as a corrupt rabbinate. That has been exaggerated. But to the degree that it did exist, it invited the Hasidic Reformation. The shift towards the common and the simple person characterizes not just Hasidut, but the Romantics as well, and can be easily discerned in Wordsworth's preface to his lyrical ballads. When Wordsworth composed the lyrical ballads, he revolutionized the way people view poetry. Poetry was now written in simple language and dealt with simple, common matters, shepherds, nurses, schoolboys, rather than the typical epic subject for poetry, great and mighty warriors. I'll quote to you his defense. "The majority of the following poems," he writes, "are to be considered as experiments. They were written chiefly with a view to ascertain how far the language of conversation in the middle and lower classes of society is adapted to the purpose of poetic pleasure. It contains a natural delineation of human passions, human characters, and human incidents, as opposed to the heroic and exalted subject matter of classic poetry. The principal object, then, which I proposed to myself in these poems was to choose incidents and situations from common life and to relate or describe them throughout, as far as possible, in a selection of language really used by men. Typically, such low and rustic subject matter was deemed inappropriate or indecorous. It didn't meet the pattern of decorum for great works of art. But the Romantics launched a new form of poetry, which would draw its very vitality and its authenticity precisely because it addressed the common, the daily, and the genuine." Given these four points of commonality, A, that each was a revolutionary movement, B, that each was a revivalist movement, C, that each was an anti-rationalist movement, and D, that they sought to reach out to the common and to bridge a gap which was developing, it would seem abundantly clear that these two movements shared more in common than merely the epoch in which they germinated and later dominated. A more careful explanation might demonstrate a genuine correspondence. I will try to divide my comments into two sections. Initially, we will seek the similarity at an ideological level, in terms of the cosmogony, the universal history, the philosophy, which was adopted by each movement. Afterwards, I will attempt to demonstrate how each movement was forced to modify these classic ideologies to correct the post-revolutionary disillusionment which they each confronted. Quite often, a movement is successful because of its ability to propose a coherent and consistent overall scheme for the universal history of humanity, what is known as cosmogony, a history which spans creation, salvation, and the resolution of history. Sometimes a movement, its very success lies in its ability to span and to provide an overall focus of human history. In our instance, both the Hasidim and the Romantics embraced the very same classical history of the universe. They elaborated upon it, and they established this quote-unquote hereditary wisdom as the cardinal principle of their new ideology. This scheme of universal history, which we might label radical monism, was introduced to Western civilization by Plotinus in his Aeneids, and proposed the following. The first principle of creation, the first principle of the world, is known as the One. And this original state of the One, where everything is unified, is identical with the state of the Good. The One and the Good, capital O and capital G. The religious varieties of this theory changed the state of the good into the state of God, where the only thing which existed was God, who is, of course, good. There is no differentiation. Hashem is Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And by the very virtue of the goodness of, at least according to the religious varieties of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this goodness tends to overflow and begins to emerge and emanate in a long series of stages. Goodness by its nature, chesed, has to overflow. It begins to emerge in stages which we recognize as the creation of the universe. Briyas Ha'olam, according to this theory, is emanation, emergence of the oneness of God into multiplicity. The farthest possible edge of this series of emanation is what we know as our material universe, the world in which we live. Each successive scale of this emanation, of this emergence, represents a higher degree of division. Remember, everything starts with the one, which is undifferentiated. Begins to emerge in successive degrees of differentiation. And it's further remote, of course, from the one. Evil materializes only in the final and most distant level and exists as a privation of unity. Unity, undifferentiation, that is good. That is Tov. Multiplicity, division, differentiation, that is evil. And moral evil, human evil, represents a man turning his attention from the good and from the unity, turning his attention and becoming mired in a material realm of division and fragmentation. Creation in this respect is really the first fall. Eating from the Eitz Hadas or getting consciousness of evil or moral consciousness, that is only the second fall. The first fall necessarily occurs when the world is created, when the one is differentiated, when fragmentation ensues. It is certainly not difficult to recognize the profound influence which this theory has had upon Western civilization and, as we will soon see, upon our own culture. Ultimately, this passage, this procession of emanation is not unbounded or linear. Plotinus proposed a final counter-process, a return to unity, which he called epistrophe, which gave this whole scheme a circular shape. It starts at a certain point, it emanates and differentiates and returns back to its point of origin. A return of the sundered creation back to its primal solidarity, to its initial unity. This sequence of lost unity and ultimately of regained unity, what was known to the German philosophers as universal Geschichte, formed the cornerstone of a self-sustaining system which Hegel, Schelling, and Schiller all developed. In their opinion, a fall into division inaugurated the dynamic of thesis and antithesis, which according to Hegel was the moving principle of the concept, the dialectic. Without differences, there cannot be any momentum, there cannot be any movement. This difference, thesis, antithesis, and the resolution into synthesis is the engine which drove the universe. As Schelling writes, contradiction is life's mainspring and core. If there were only unity, and if everything were at peace, then truly nothing would want to stir, and everything would sink into listlessness. Or as Blake declares in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, without contraries, there is no progression. Attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate are necessary to human existence. To the Hasidim, of course, this very same motif was furnished by the Kabbalah. Creation, according to Kabbalah, entails a tzimtzum, the withdrawal of the Ein Sof, the withdrawal of the impersonal, the indifferent unity, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or as it's referred to, as he is referred to, the Deus Ex Candidus. Hashem in his unity, in his full unity, encompasses the entire world. So in order for creation to exist, in order for creation to occur, Hashem has to withdraw to be mitzamtzem so that there is room for the world to be brought into existence. From the Ein Sof, from the highest and most basic definition of a Kodesh Baruch Hu known to man, into this newly created space, which was created by his withdrawal, emanated spheres of divine light, literally spheros, the divine light overspilled, which were stages in the revelation of God's creative power. Hashem himself is immanent as he sustains these various spheres and serves as the union and the root of all these spheres, of all these contradictions. As we know, differentiation ensued during the events known as Shevirat HaKelim. The vessels which were meant to contain the divine light, the isolated beams of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence, burst. These vessels were not capable of containing God's Shechina, and they allowed the divine sparks to overspill, to escape, to migrate towards the world of evil, and to nourish the world of evil. From this sundered world, these divine sparks must be retrieved, the epistrophe, circling back to the point of origin, through the process known as tikkun, in which the tzaddik plays the central role of cosmic hero. He rescues the divine sparks and returns them to their original state of unity. Creation is fragmentation, differentiation. The final state of history is circling back to the primal state of unity. Unification of these divine sparks is achieved through man's mitzvot and his deeds, but most importantly, through his thoughts, through his kavana. By intense contemplation upon the hidden unity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and by perceiving and uncovering the divine spirit which illumines all, man can rescue, the tzaddik can rescue these scattered lights and reconstitute them into their original state of unity. I must admit that this entire theory is certainly not the innovation of the Hasidim. This is traditional Kabbalah, this is the Kabbalah Sari. The Hasidim merely re-established this myth. They re-emphasized this myth as the center point of Jewish experience. Their contribution was in their insistence that what had been a very sophisticated and esoteric program could be realized instead as a democratic vision, attainable by all. Everyone could participate in Kabbalah, according to the Hasidim. We have shown so far that both the Hasidim and the Romantics adopted the very same version of universal history, what could be called cosmogony. The initial state, pre-creation state, the definition of the experience of creation as a differentiation of unity, a unity which was really the essential character of God, or its non-religious varieties, good, and that multiplicity and division is the reason for evil in the world, that ultimately redemption, salvation was circular, that it returns back to its point of initial unity. We can further glimpse the pivotal role which this system, what is known as Neoplatonic monism, this history, the system of history, the pivotal role which this plays can be best understood by the metaphors which the Hasidim and the Romantics used to describe this process. The process is a very philosophical one, and as some of you are beginning to understand, it's very difficult to present this universal history in philosophic terms and have it be understood by the mass of people, by the larger population. So oftentimes a religion, a movement, will try to describe these in some sort of metaphor so that the basic gist of the concept can be easily understood by the audience. As each movement laid stress to unification as the authentic form of redemption, again, unity is redemption, differentiation is tragedy. The most suitable metaphor, which is imaginable for unity, is clearly human marriage, the state of the human relationship, which most clearly approximates oneness. When do we see two things becoming one in the most visible term? Through marriage. The use of marriage as a figure for redemption resurfaces throughout the Romantic movement and the Hasidic movement. The spousal metaphor, of course, enjoys its greatest prominence in the works of Wordsworth, as a poetry, as a holy marriage between the mind of man and external nature. As he writes, "I, long before the blissful hour arrives, would chant in lonely peace the spousal verse of this great consummation between man and nature." In Chassidut, a similar metaphor, the marriage metaphor, is employed to signify the unification of the separated spheros, as well as the union or communion between man and the Rabbonu Shel Olam. In a famous letter, the Baal Shem Tov writes, quote, "You know how great is the joy when bride and bridegroom unite in this world of smallness and materialism. How much greater then is the joy at this lofty stage in the spheros and Shemayim?" Somewhat arresting, though, is the degree to which the Hasidim took this image. In many cases, this metaphor reached very extreme and even drastic proportions. In defending the value of violent gesture during tefillos, and as you know, many Hasidim engaged in very violent activities during their tefillos, in defending this, one Rebbe stated, quote, "Just as no child can be born as a result of physical copulation, unless this is performed with a vitalized organ and with joy and desire, so it is with spiritual copulation. That is, the study of Torah and prayer, tefillah. When it is performed with a vitalized organ and with joy and delight, then does it give birth. And there are additional instances in which the imagery is not just spousal or conjugal, but becomes outright sexual and even erotic. Much of the Hasidic innovation, and according to many, the Hasidic violation, lies in its employment in these images within the relationship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and man. And understandably, this metaphor, this sexual metaphor, figured prominently in the attacks which were launched against the Hasidim. There's an attack by a famous Litvish Rav known as Migalet Mirim, in which this notion is really assailed, is really dismissed. And of course, the Romantics as well readily used sexual metaphor. Anyone who's familiar with William Blake's writings, his illuminated plates, his artwork, can understand how much of a controlling image this is in his work. A second parable, a second metaphor, aside from the metaphor of marriage, which was used by the Romantics and the Hasidim, is that of the wandering prince, the lost son, the pilgrim who returns to the house of his father. In the Hasidic literature, this story takes the famous, it's a famous story which is told and retold almost in every Sefer Hasidut. It takes the form of the king's son, the prince, who is sent away from the palace so that he might afterwards yearn more for his father's house. He has to be sent into exile so that he wants to return. However, when he is sent into Galus, he begins to mingle with the villagers and forgets the royal pleasures of his youth. One nobleman after another tries to return him to his father's castle. And finally, it is only the noble who adopts an unorthodox method. He masks himself in beggar's clothing so that he may begin to communicate with the wandering son and assist his return to his father's house. Again, note the importance for the Hasidim. It is only the Rebbe who can dress like the common man, who can talk like the common man, who succeeds in returning the common man back to his father's table, back to the Shulchan Gavoa. In Romantic literature, this parable occurred as well in a journey, in a return to a fatherland. Hegel's process, known as the veg, self-education along the road of life, literally a veg, incorporates this universal pilgrimage. It's most notable in Coleridge's work, The Ancient Mariner, in which the mariner embarks on a journey. He becomes estranged from the universal community, from life, from love. He is, quote, alone, alone, all alone, alone on a wide sea. And finally, the pilgrimage returns back to its initial starting point after he has learned the moral lessons of community and he has assimilated the lessons which were necessary. He begins to see the lighthouse top by sea. Oh, dream of joy. Is this indeed? Is this the hill? Is this the kirk? Is this mine own country? And now, all in my own country, I stood on firm land. The return of the wandering son back to his fatherland. The return of history from differentiation, from division, from evil, back to its original point of primal unity with God. The marriage metaphor, the metaphor of the wandering son, were adopted by each of these movements in trying to translate this very complicated scheme of history into something which was palatable. If each movement clearly adopted this scheme of history, if the entire visible world emanates from a common source, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, then presumably there must remain a single spirit which infuses the entire world, which rolls through the entire universe. And it is by looking past the physical appearances which divide to the supernal spirit, to the internal spirit which unites, that humanity, that mankind can propel the redemptive process. Again, creation is unity being sundered into division. Trying the way in which you bring it back to its state of unity is by looking to the spirit that unifies rather than to the material which divides. And this form of what is known as idealism, looking for the ideal, the spirits beyond the reality, was also shared by each movement. It must be emphasized that each movement, as they occurred in a completely different arena, each of them detected this spirit, the spirit of a Kodesh Baruch Hu for the Hasidim, the unifying spirit to the Romantics. Each of them detected this spirit in a completely different landscape. However, it was the same spirit in theory which they were seeking for. To the Romantics, of course, the unifying spirit was best discernible in nature. The imagination provides the poet with a double vision, which allows him to see objects as entrance gates into a world which is hidden from view by nature, as accessing the spirit. Nature no longer is a sterile landscape, but begins to swarm with sensation, with spirit, and is endowed with an eternal force. The Hasidim, most of them at least, were not especially nature lovers. And even if they were, they had more pressing matters to attend to. For all the newfound romantic love and affiliation with nature, it still must be emphasized that they were operating within a 2,000 year tradition of poetry pertaining to nature. So although they emphasized nature and they underscored it, they certainly were picking up upon their heritage, a heritage which the Hasidim didn't have. The Hasidim had to look to a different landscape within which the spirit of a Kodesh Baruch Hu was resting. They infused Torah, Tefillah, Mitzvot. These activities became infused with divine spirits, with divine presence. The Torah became a living organism, which was animated by a secret life, which streams and pulsates below the crust of its literal meaning. When they learned, it wasn't just to understand Pshat or the Lamdas or the Hakira, but to see the Ruach Elohim within the Torah. Torah didn't consist merely of chapters and phrases and words, but it was the incarnation of the Chachmas Elohim, of an eternal spirit which reflected original unity and which constantly sent out rays of light throughout the entire Bria. Interestingly enough, this notion of the internal spirit within Torah, within Tefillah, led to a radical metamorphosis on the part of the Hasidim, a change, an alteration in traditional Kabbalah. Kabbalah Tari had emphasized the role of Kavanah, meditating upon the Sfiros, upon the attributes of the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Each word in Tefillah, aside from its own meaning, partakes and participates of an aspect of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And by being miskaving to these Sfiros, by thinking about them and meditating upon them, a tzaddik or a regular person could assist in the unification of the divine names and in the flow of the divine Shekhinah throughout creation. The Hasidim altered this process. They took this notion of Kavana and simplified it into what was known as the theory of the attachment of the letters. I will repeat the letter of the Baal Shem Tov, part of which I quoted earlier. You must have the intention of unifying a name whenever your mouth utters a word at the time you pray and study the Torah. In every word, worlds, souls, and divinity exist which ascend to become bound to one another. Then the letters become bound and united one to the other to form a word, and they become united with a true unification in the divine. You must allow your soul to become united with them at every stage of the above. Then all the worlds become united as one, and they ascend, so that there is immeasurable joy and delight. And then he goes on into the image of the bride and the bridegroom. To the Baal Shem Tov, the actual letters, the otios themselves, not just what they meant, what they referred to, the actual letters themselves symbolize metaphysical realities, contain creative energy. Unifying letters into words was equivalent to unifying the creative powers of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and of course participating in the divine unity. According to the Hasidim, all that was required was reflecting upon the anatomy of the words, seeing how the letters combine to form words, how the words combine to form sentences, sentences into paragraphs, paragraphs into chapters. Not to contemplate the actual meaning of the words. And of course, this allowed the Hasidim to extend Kabbalah to the common man. It's much easier for the common man who isn't versed in Kabbalah, who isn't the big Talmud Chacham, to think simply about letters and words and chapters, and these appear to him literally in black and white. He opens the Siddur, and then he sees how letters are uniting into words, etc. It's far more difficult for this person to think about the Sfiros, and to think about Malchus and Gevura, and how they unite into one another. So I've so far demonstrated how each of the movements tended to adopt a common universal history, using the same metaphors, and looking for that same spirit which still united the divided universe. Even though the universe physically is divided, as the universe emanated from the original point of unity, that spirit still pulses. However, what truly singles out the Romantics and the Hasidim is the manner in which they personalized and interiorized this scheme of redemption. Each of these movements, both the Hasidim and the Romantics, confronted a failed revolution. And of course, they confronted the dashed hopes and widespread despondency which generally surfaces in the wake of a failed revolution. It became the challenge of the Hasidim, the challenge of the Romantics, to redirect the rejuvenative factor of the revolutions and package them in a different manner, in a manner which would be more acceptable to the post-revolutionary person, to the person who is disillusioned with revolution, who is disillusioned with redeeming world history. To any reader of the Romantic movement, or the Romantic literature, the movement is eternally bound to the French Revolution. The revolution of 1789, which excited such hope and optimism, as the poet Robert Southey remarked, few persons but those who have lived in it can conceive or comprehend what the memory of the French Revolution was, nor what a visionary world seemed to open upon those who were just entering it. Old things seemed to pass away, and nothing was dreamt of but the regeneration of the human race. The entire community, and certainly the intellectual community of Europe, was intoxicated with the prospect of utopia, the prospect which Coleridge remarked, from the general heart of humankind, hope sprang forth like a full-born deity. All the Europeans were looking towards the fulfillment of the biblical prophecies, the achievement of an apocalyptic utopia. Ironically, though, the truly great romantic works were composed not under the dizzying spell of the early part of the revolution, but under the somber disillusionment of the disastrous conclusion of the revolution, as we all know. The Romantics, instead of severing themselves and their poetry from this tragic past, this formative past, transformed the scope and the vision of their dreams into a new myth. External redemption was replaced by internal redemption, internal paradise. The high romantic argument was an unflinching belief in the power of the human imagination to transform the universe and to usher in a paradise on this world through his own powers. As M.H. Abrams so appropriately put it, apocalypse by revolution to the Romantics was substituted for by apocalypse of the imagination. Instead of the utopia being achieved by political means, everything was invested into a new scheme of internal imaginative revolution. Personal redemption, the resurrection of imagination, a higher level of community between man and his fellow creatures, and a union between human and nature, these internal transformations were meant to replace social, political revolution. The militancy of overt political action, which had entranced the Romantics, was replaced by a spiritual quietism, a reformation of consciousness, an internal revolution. The hope for cosmic reunification was replaced by a personal quest to heal the division between man and man, between man and the world, if never between man and man. The Romantics were initially inspired by revolutionary fervor, and subsequently they were forced to adjust their bearings to deal with despondency, to deal with disillusionment. The Hasidim, by contrast, arrived on the scene not during the early stages of an optimism, of a revolution, of great expectations, but instead they arrived on the scene after one of the most controversial and fractious Jewish messianic movements had split, had sundered the very foundations of Judaism. The acute aftershocks of the Shabtai Tzvi debacle have been keenly felt, and have been keenly felt, within the Jewish community ever since his apostasy in 1666. Throughout the ensuing century, bitter disputes surfaced surrounding accusations that people had against others whom they thought sympathized with Sabbateanism, with underground Sabbatean movements, the Frankist movement being the most famous. Whatever remained of the Jewish political infrastructure had been shattered by decades of disputes, which finally culminated in the dissolution of the Vaad Arba Arotzos, the Council of the Four Lands, which had been the main source of the Jewish organizational strength, at least for Polish Jewry. At a popular level, abject poverty was compounded by fatalistic gloom. Inferior political status was aggravated by loss of faith in the Jewish leadership. Indeed, in Eastern Europe in the 18th century, the stakes were not as high as they were 50 years later in France. But to the Jewish serf, the future seemed bleak, and any tinges of messianic rescue were scoffed at. Chassidut emerged under this Sabbatean cloud. Its founders were confronted with great suspicion, a suspicion which expressed itself at the popular level in distrust, and at the rabbinic level in armed resistance. They emphasized the Hasidim mystical contemplation above traditional Talmud Torah, tefillah above Torah. They made minor changes in halacha to accommodate their unique program. They criticized the established leadership for distancing themselves from the public. To the onlooker, Hasidut had all the trappings of a Sabbateanist offspring movement, and early on the Hasidim suffered terribly through this association. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, the author of the Toldos Yaakov Yosef, the Talmud of the Baal Shem, was literally ridden out of town, the town in which he was the Rav, upon their discovery of his Hasidic inclinations. And I do not have to recount to this audience, as Nadia remarked, the Litvish audience, the bitter and virulent counterattack which was spearheaded by the Grah, by the Gaon, against the Hasidim. So terrible and threatening was the menace of Sabbateanism that any movement which displayed even slight antinomian inclination, any movement which talked about messianism, which talked about changing, was assaulted with the force and energy of an entire community. How did Hasidut survive? How did they respond? How did they assure the community that they were not Sabbateanists? To launch their successful reform, they were forced to dispel any allegations of Sabbatean similarity, and they were forced to mute messianic elements. Hasidut differed from Sabbateanism, mainly in that it rejected overt messianism, belief in or trying to accelerate Mashiach, the messianism of the Shabtai Tzvi, and they replaced it instead with personal redemption. Again, external redemption, political action, revolution becomes internal. According to Kabbalah, and according to the Ari HaKadosh, the ideal of the universe is known as the process of tikkun. All Ma'asim Tovim, all Torah, return plays a cosmic role in redirecting history towards its inevitable resolution, towards that state of unification, capturing the divine sparks. Every tefillah, every mitzvah had an eye towards tikkun, towards redeeming the universe, towards revolutionizing the universe, or creating the revolution. It was this program which the Ari had popularized, but it was this program which incited and helped the aberrations of the Sabbateanists. If the ideal in life is tikkun, then possibly any activity can be justified because it plays a role within the process of tikkun, even chas v'shalom violations of halacha. This is known as antinomianism, the justification of violating halacha so that you could be mitaking the olam in a broader sense. The Hasidim substituted for tikkun a principle known as dveikut, not tikkun, but devekut. Literally, the person himself cleaving to the Ribbono Shel Olam. The highest ideal and goal of mystical life became the entry into a personal state of close and intimate communion with Kodesh Baruch Hu. Not repairing the world, that wasn't as important as the personal union. A mere awareness of the presence of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, which suffuses all, could produce the desired result. Literally, classic unio mystica. Communing with God, not becoming God, chas v'shalom, as another religion, but becoming one with Him. This now dominated Hasidic life. Hasidut attempted to preserve Kabbalah. However, to preserve only those elements which were capable of evoking popular response, but stripping the messianic flavor, which had been responsible for so much suffering and so much strife. Tikkun, messianism, external redemption was rejected. Personal salvation, imaginative ascendance towards the Kodesh Baruch Hu, was emphasized. This theory, the replacement of Devekut for Tikkun, essentially is the position of Gershon Sholem in his book, Essays on Jewish Messianism, and has come under some fire in recent years, and there are certainly people in this room who could argue this issue with greater expertise than myself. But I distinctly detect this shift, maybe not in the same degree as Sholem, but certainly a shift from external redemption towards personal salvation. It is in this aspect that Hasidut mirrors, for slightly different reasons, of course, the Romantic movement. Each movement evolved under the shadow of revolutions which had figured so neatly into the universal historical scheme. Each revolution had excited hopes of Mashiach, a return to paradise, to Gan Eden. Unfortunately, each of these revolutions failed, and failed miserably. The French Revolution and the Shabtai Tzvi. And each revolution created in its wake despair, hopelessness, overall gloom. The Hasidim and the Romantics sought to restore hope and to repair the just as to the Hasidim, cosmic patterns of universal redemption, of tikkun, were internalized into a program of private and quietistic devekus with a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Allow me to conclude with a self-critique, an overall reflection upon this issue and issues of this sort, comparing the Hasidim to the Romantics or any such comparisons. There are many, I'm sure, who would level the claim that this exercise today has belittled the importance of Hasidus, and by comparing it to the Romantics and asserting that each movement evolved from similar socio-political conditions, I have, in a sense, sterilized the Hasidim of their Kedusha, and of their saintliness, and of their mission. After all, they were nothing more than Jewish Romantics. Their intense tefillah was the equivalent of a romantic elegy to nature. Each movement was merely the unwilling product of external climate. In response to this, allow me to cite, briefly, a remark of William James. In the first chapter of The Varieties of Religious Experience, he discusses the issue of what he labels medical materialism, the position which attempts to link religious experience, authentic religious experience, to psychological or neurological factors. Religious melancholy, someone who engages in cheshbon hanefesh, that's only because he has bad digestion. Belief in immortality, someone who believes in Olam Haba passionately, that's merely because of his emotional temperament. Very emotional. Extreme conscientiousness, moral fiber, tzidkus, that's only because he has over-instigated nerves. This was a theory which had been popularized in the days of James, past century, and many religious people detected in this approach an attempt to undermine or belittle the meaning of religious experience. It's only, after all these experiences aren't authentic, they're merely the offshoots of overactive nerves, of zealous hormones, the same physiological factors which in other people can spur demented behavior. Dementia, religion, just depends how the cards fall, how the cookie crumbles. James responds by differentiating between two questions. An existential question: how did something come into existence? What was its cause? What was its root? And the second, the derivation, and the second question, the proposition of value, spiritual judgment. Once we decide how something evolves, what value do we attach to that phenomena? Isolating the cause or a source of something, the existential question, how did it come about, how did it derive, does not in any way influence the value which we assign to a certain phenomena. Spiritual value is never undone merely because we can identify common or lowly origin. In addition, in his words, quote, it always leads to a better understanding of a thing's significance to consider its exaggerations and perversions, its equivalents and substitutes, and nearest relatives elsewhere. Not that we may thereby swamp the thing in the wholesale condemnation which we pass on its inferior congeners, but rather that we may, by contrast, ascertain the more precisely in what its merits consist by learning at the same time to what particular dangers of corruption it may also be exposed. End quote. Obviously, Hasidus holds greater importance, religious importance for us as B'nai Torah, than does Romanticism. Though their value, the value of Hasidus and the value of Romanticism, is discrepant, their origin, their existential source, how do they derive, is quite similar. And by attuning ourselves to this correspondence, we may discover ourselves better able to appreciate the value of each.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.